From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Pasta shapes are an iconography, a language. The dozens of shapes and their names tell us about places and fantasy and practicalities. Most have been in existence for decades or even centuries. It is exceedingly difficult to create a new shape and have it embraced by enough people to allow it to take a place in the iconography. And yet, this is what Dan Pashman is on a mission to do. Perhaps you've heard Dan on his podcast, The Sporkful. He's always looking at the foodverse from a slightly different angle than anyone else, and oftentimes his opinions are, well, let's just say controversial.
I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Spaghetti sucks. Thank you.
I've spent the last couple of years playing spiritual pasta advisor to Dan on his journey to create a brand new pasta shape. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Evan. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. Excited about pasta. I've been eating a lot of it.
I bet. I remember our very first conversation and how shocked you were when I told you that I thought it was going to be a lot harder than you think it's going to be.
Yes, I was very naive. I mean, I assumed, like with any great quest, that I would hit roadblocks, but I just felt like, I don't know, it seemed to me like, sure, there's a lot of shapes out there, but they kind of all seem like variations on a theme. They didn't seem all that imaginative to me, most of them. And I felt like, why wouldn't some pasta company out there want to partner with me and try to do something new? It seemed like a no-brainer. But I was wrong. It was very, very hard.
So where did you start? What was the very first thing you did that was the first step to actually committing to do it?
Well, the first thing I did was call you, Evan, because I know that you know a lot more about pasta than I do. That's why I enlisted you as my pasta fairy godmother and spiritual advisor on my quest. And you did not disappoint. So I've been, you know, relying on your counsel now for several years since this journey began. But, you know, you gave me great advice. You said the first thing you got to do, you got to do a couple of things. You got to learn about where pasta comes from, the basic ingredients. So I went to North Dakota. This is way before COVID, to the pasta lab there where they develop a lot of the wheat that ends up in pasta sold in America. And then I started eating a bunch of pasta shapes. I scoured the whole New York metro area looking for obscure shapes, and I ate every shape I could get my teeth on. And tried to, you know, some of them I had eaten before, but I wanted to go about it in a methodical way. Like, what do I like smooth or do I like ridges? Do I like curls? Do I like ruffles? Do I like thick or thin or long or short? And try to really catalog attributes and narrow down options to come up with something great.
So you have this engineer's mind when it comes to food in general. So what criteria did you develop to judge shapes by?
So I have identified three criteria that I think you can use to judge all pasta shapes. The first is forkability. How easy is it to get the shape on your fork and keep it there? Number two, sauceability. How readily does sauce adhere to the shape? Number three, and the most important of all, I believe, tooth sinkability. How satisfying is it to sink your teeth into it? And I think most shapes have a problem in at least one of these three areas. And I wanted to make a shape that would be great in all three.
So wanting to upend a world means that you have problems with that world to begin with. So can you get specific in terms of one or two pasta shapes and brutalize them for me?
Oh, with pleasure. I mean, on top of spaghetti, you got your linguine and fettuccine. Those just like the sauce does not adhere to them. They're too smooth. A lot of the tube pastas, rigatoni, penne, ziti, they spring off your fork. They're not forkable. Angel hair is not tooth sinkable. It goes from zero to mush in 30 seconds. Farfalle, the bow ties and wagon wheels, those are gimmicks. You know, they don't cook evenly. They're no good. And even the shapes that I love, like pappardelle, I love pappardelle, the wide flat one, but still it's kind of a one note song. After a few bites, you're just sort of eating a lot of dough. I just think that we have to be able to do better.
You know, as you were talking, I felt like in my mind I was on a debate stage and wanted to throw you under the bus for every single opinion. So what shape did you hone in on that stood out above all else for you?
Well, I can't get too far into the details as we just launched the project, but I would say that the first shape in my early testing that catches my eye is Mafalda, also known as Mafaldina.
Describe it. So
that, if you picture like a fettuccine, long, flat noodle, except along the edges, all up and down the noodle, are ruffles. There's a lasagna like this, so you know that's long and flat with ruffles on the side. So imagine like a lasagna, but narrow, so you could twirl it on a fork. And it is a fantastic shape. I love that you can twirl it on the fork and get a rich, meaty, tooth-sinkable bite. But then the ruffles pick up a lot of sauce, much more sauce than you get with a like fettuccine, linguine, spaghetti. These classic shapes are not sauceable. They don't hold a good amount of sauce. Doesn't matter what kind of sauce it is. Other shapes hold sauce better. So the Mafalda adds those ruffles that pick up a lot of sauce, thick or thin sauce, all kinds. Plus, ruffles are just fun in your mouth. They add an extra textural sensation, which is very delightful. So I start off with the Mafalda as my base canvas. But, you know, I know I have to build from there. But I don't want a gimmick. I want to be very clear. My podcast is called The Sporkful. Some people are like, oh, why don't you make it like a spork-shaped pasta? Like, no, I don't want a point-of-purchase item at Bed Bath & Beyond. I want a legitimately great pasta shape, okay? I bought the pasta at Bed Bath & Beyond. It's not great. I didn't want that. I wanted a legitimately great pasta shape that would stand the test of time. And so, you know, I wanted to take some of the wisdom that exists in the pasta canon, some things that I like, and bring them together in a new way.
So in going about this quest, you're kind of putting on many hats. You're like expecting yourself to be kind of an engineer designer, and then you're going to have to navigate like food science and then industrial processes of like creating dyes and getting to know professional pasta designers and then production, I would imagine. So who is like the first person that you're going to talk to that's a professional to find out whether or not this is a pipe dream or something that can actually happen?
Well, the two things that I need beyond an idea for a shape, the two sort of people that I need to make this a reality are, first, I need a pasta dye maker. The dye is like the mold. So I need to get someone to make me a dye that can manufacture the shape that I have conceived. Then I need to take that dye to a pasta company, because I'm not going to start, you know, I'm not going to lease a factory and start buying equipment. I need to partner with a pasta company that has the expertise, that has the machinery. So I got to get the dye and I got to bring it to a company that's excited to work with me. And hopefully those companies will exist. But as I set out, those two pieces that I just summarized in about 30 seconds turn out to be incredibly challenging. And so many obstacles come up that I never anticipated, including but not limited to COVID, which certainly threw a wrench in the works.
And I would imagine that cost has got to enter into this somehow. I mean, I don't think your wife is interested in drawing down your savings account.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel as I start out on this journey that I can get a pasta company to partner with me. And they'll help to defray some of the cost and also share in the profit if there ever is any. But yeah, I haven't really, as I start the journey, I have not really told my wife what might be involved. The business part of things, it turns out to be a lot more difficult than I expected. I figured that like pasta, why wouldn't a pasta company want to partner with me? Like, it'll be fun. Like who, and if you end up with like an exclusive license to this new shape, like that's great. And it's not that big of an ask, especially for a big company that has teams of engineers. Well, it turns out I was wrong.
What a surprise. I want us to be in the same space and I want to cook some of those pasta shapes for you that you brutalize to show you that they're not that bad.
I'll bring my whole family. They'll be thrilled.
I can't wait to catch up with you on our next conversation along this magical quest of yours.
Thanks, Evan.
That was Dan Pashman, host of The Sporkful. The first two episodes of this pasta series drop this Monday, March 1st. Tune into the podcast to find out what happens, and then we'll check back in with Dan in a few weeks when he launches his brand new pasta shape. Coming up, get your planter beds ready, because Tomato Mania is back. It's your once-a-year chance to shop nearly 300 varieties of tomato seedlings. We've got the details when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. How about some good news? Here in Southern California, tomato planting season is nigh. The first Tomato Mania sale of 2021 is this weekend, which means that in the coming weeks, backyard gardeners across the Southland will flock to Tomato Mania events to shop hundreds of varieties of tomato seedlings. As you've heard me say many times before, the garden is saving me. It really helps tamp down the anxiety. So I'm thrilled to welcome Scott Daig of Tomato Mania to find out what we can expect from this year's tomato extravaganza. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Evan. So great to talk to you. Always love talking to you, and especially at the top of the spring, or, well, when spring is coming, since we've got lots to talk about.
I know. I always feel like this conversation with you marks like a really important season. For people who have never experienced it, could you describe what Tomato Mania is?
Gosh, Evan, we're at the heart of it, we are a tomato seedling sale. And we seek out and grow and test and then offer a huge list of heirloom, classic, rare, all these kinds of tomatoes for home gardeners to use in their gardens, wherever they turn the soil. And that's what we do. We have sales throughout California. This has been going on now for almost, 30 years. And it's a roadshow these days it's a tomato seedling pop-up. We love it.
To give people an idea of the breadth of it, about how many different varieties of seedlings do you typically have on offer?
Well, when we put our list together at the beginning of the year, we probably grow out about 200 varieties. But what that does is that amplifies the list that's already out there that so many good growers are providing for me and for everybody else who grows tomatoes. So we grow those things that nobody else is growing in the commercial trade. And then that sort of, we sort of split that all through our events. So we have some large events, some small events. At our biggest one, we probably are approaching 275 varieties on the sales floor.
I'm so curious about what form Tomato Mania is going to take this year. I remember last year, your first day of opening at Tapia Brothers was actually the day that we were put into lockdown. And I flew there in my truck because I knew if I didn't go, I would kick myself. Because you don't only have seedlings, you also have pots, you have soil, you have things for the plants to climb on. So this year, what form is it going to take?
Well, I guess the best way to say that probably is that each sale will be different based on how much space we have, the kind of access we have, the kind of staff or assistance we have at a specific site. So in some places, we actually will have a bit fewer seedling choices than we've had in the past, so we can spread things out. In some areas, you will have restricted entry. Masks will be required, and all the regular CDC and other requirements will be insisted upon at these sales wherever they are. And then what we're also trying to do, Evan, is that normally, as a pop-up, a literal pop-up, we're in a location for a day or a weekend or an extended weekend, right? And this year, we're going to, in almost all of our locations, we will spread the sale out. And that will give people more opportunities to shop. We will do a more intense job of sort of restocking so that everybody doesn't miss, what they're after or that special tomato. And then that just gives people, more opportunities to feel comfortable in the space and be able to get what they want for the garden at the same time.
Okay, let's get to the tomatoes. Every year you have a special pick. What is it for this year?
This one, it's a little saladette tomato called Lava Flow. It's our tomato of the year. And we've had, obviously, we've had all different kinds sort of in this award situation as we've done it over the past few years. A big red, a beautiful terracotta, a small black one. This one is a lovely, almost, I call it a luminous gold. It looks like it's lit from within, but it is a saladette type that's about generally 3 to 4 ounces. So it fits nicely in the palm of your hand. It's this beautiful gold with red stripes all over the outside. And the inside is flush with red and gold. And it's just a tremendous multi-purpose tomato. We've seen it work well in lots of different situations, whether a pot, the coast, inland. We know it works everywhere and people love it. And we can't wait to introduce everybody to it.
So this year you have something that I'm really, really excited about, since all of my planting is done in containers. You have something very special, dwarf heirloom varieties. First of all, I think of those two words, dwarf and heirloom, and I think to myself, how is that possible?
The concept of a dwarf tomato is not new. This has been going on for 100 years, as you know, some breeders just opted to have these more compact tomatoes, and it works. And again, has been working for a century. But over the last 10, 12 years, a group of devoted hybridizers have been tying in heirloom varieties to those genetics of the dwarfs that even appeared so many years ago. And what they've created, and these are hybridizers all over the world who worked in concert to share genetics and share seeds and share not only goodwill, but knowledge about these varieties. And so what you end up with is a collection of tomatoes that runs the gamut, from large tomatoes to small, beefsteak to cherry, from stripes to exotic colors to a beautiful, you know, beautiful round reds that we're used to and all of that. So you get in this new dwarf series all the options that you had in the heirloom tomatoes, including taste, which obviously we demand. But boy, what you get on the practical side of things is you get a tomato that generally won't be over, 3 feet tall.
3 feet tall?
3 feet tall.
You don't even really need to stake them then.
Bingo. Isn't that amazing? I mean, one small cane or whatever, and you could be done for the season in terms of keeping that baby upright. And truth be told, we've carried these in our lineup for years. We've had them in Tomato Mania has showcased small varieties for years. You know the classics, like the Bush series, Bush Early Girl, Bush Champion, Bush this and that. The Huskies, Husky Red, Husky Gold. We've had these hybrids forever. And people enjoy them, and there they are. They live alongside the other tomatoes, and they've sort of been present through all the years. Well, these heirloom varieties and the color and all of that piqued our interest, so we trialed them in a big way last year. And we were really kind of astounded. And obviously, the first thing that I used to think about dwarfs is, well, I'll have to get fewer tomatoes on, this year and all of that. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. It's really amazing. You get a shorter, thicker, compact plant that holds itself up well, and or more on its own or more independently. And the fruit production on many of these is astounding.
So for these types of tomato plants, what size pot would be ideal for them?
Well, here's the thing. You know that you and I talk a lot about, hey, you want a tomato in a pot? Use a big one, and the bigger the better, and that's always the rule. We have established for a regular size tomato plant, don't do anything smaller than 15 by 15. 15 inches by 15 inches. That's pretty big. And if you can go bigger, more real estate, the better they're going to like it and the better you're going to do. So imagine you have that same pot you used last year for a regular sized heirloom or hybrid plant. I can tell you, Evan, that I don't have a problem with you doing two of these dwarfs in that pot. And if you really get crazy, we did some very close planting in trials last year to see what would happen. And I think if you're a good gardener and can adequately take care of that large pot, you can do 2 to 3 of these compact plants in the space that you had one tomato in last year.
Okay, so I have a question pertaining to all of the soil that I have now in the pots that my tomatoes were growing in throughout 2020. I've taken out most of the plants, although I still have 2 or 3 that are still pumping out the tomatoes, I have to say. What do I do with all that soil? Can I reuse it?
Well, I would love to tell you that it's perfect and you don't have to worry and you can just use the soil from last year, but I would be remiss. One of the other things that we did last year in these container trials, along with the dwarfs, is that we changed out all or most of the soil that was there from the previous years. Number one, if you had any kind of downtime or disease problems in your containers, you need to change out all that soil. You just don't want bad characters hanging out in soil from last year's year and attacking plants again this year, if anything is soil borne. So change out your pots. Fresh soil, good soil, premium potting soil, that means generally expensive, a premium potting soil that is then amended like the ground. Add worm castings, add compost, add a hugely rich planting mix. An amended premium potting soil is going to get you so much more payoff as the season goes along.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to see you this year.
Thanks, Evan.
I've been speaking with Scott Daigh, owner of Power Plant Garden Design, as well as host of Tomato Mania, the largest tomato seedling sale. Head to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood, for details on where and when you can buy your tomato seedlings. Speaking of what's growing, let's head to the Santa Monica Market to see what chefs are shopping for this week in Southern California.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I am excited to be talking to Chef Ki Kim of the recently launched Nemo today. Nemo is a modern Korean pop-up based in West LA. And Ki, you are making some of the most beautiful food, I think, that exists in Los Angeles right now. You and your business partner, Arnold, are both from the New York fine dining world, and you can totally see that fine dining influence in the details in your food. Tell us a little bit about the concept and what Nemo is.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for the kind words. And Nemo is about me and Arnold. I worked at restaurants like Chungshik, Automix, Blanca in New York. Arnold actually worked at 11 Madison Park, Automix, and Burle. And we're just trying to put our experience into a to-go box, and then cater to the needs of Los Angeles.
And the main dish that you are serving is a dosirak, right? Describe what that is.
Dosirak means pento in Korean, basically. When we first came out here and all the pop-ups were thriving here, and mostly they were all Japanese chirashi pop-ups over here. And then we were like, oh, why can't we do a Korean pop-up here? So that's why we started doing dosirak instead of a pento or a chirashi.
So there's always rice, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have these individual banchans on the side, much of which comes from the farmer's market. I know today you're here looking for turnips. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you're going to do with all these turnips.
Probably gonna just steam them, because turnip itself is a very juicy, very delicious, almost a fruit-like vegetable, you know. So it's one of those ingredients where if you do too much to it, it's gonna be overwhelming. So you just want to gently cook it. And right now we're just putting them over rice with olive oil and sea salt. It's just like uni, where, you know, your best experience with uni is going to be over rice with seaweed, or just a simple uni sushi. Turnips just like that. You don't want to do too much to it.
Are you guys playing around with fermentation at all?
Oh yeah, actually, with the current collaboration with Hanshik that we did, we did turnip white kimchi instead of a red kimchi. It turned out very well. We fermented it with salt and this thing called new sugar, which is 200 times stronger than sugar, sweeter than sugar. So we just need a pinch of it, but it adds a really good accent to the fermented turnips.
And how long does that fermentation take?
Minimum 2 to 3 days. Okay. And up to 2 weeks in room temperature, and then we would refrigerate it just for the consistency.
So I know that you just wrapped up your last pop-up. What do you have coming down the pike?
This is actually company confidential. So
well, everyone's going to hear it. So
right. It's mostly company confidential, because we don't know what's going to happen next. But we're talking to a few restaurants and chefs about what's going to happen in the future, what we'll do for March. But it seems like it's going to be all exciting.
All right. Well, we will be looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Chef Ki Kim of Nemo. You can see his gorgeous Dosi Rock and find out all about the future pop-ups on Instagram. Follow them at Nemo, that's NAEMO.LA. Angela Britton is the CSA program manager at County Line Harvest, which is where Chef Ki is buying his turnips. And County Line is still doing their CSA boxes, but they've also returned to the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market. And right now they have two varieties of turnips on the table. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Jillian.
So let's start out with these varieties, starting with the classic white golf ball sized. I believe it's the Tokyo turnip, the Japanese turnip. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so our Tokyo turnips are very popular. They're also sometimes called Hakurai turnips in the culinary world. As you said, they're kind of these golf ball size or slightly bigger turnips. They're just full of flavor. To me, they really are like the first taste of spring, you know, right off of winter. They're ready to rock and roll. They're like, it's almost like eating an apple. They're just these very dense, crispy, fresh turnips. They're amazing, and I love them.
Talk a little bit about how they grow. I worked on a farm up north for a while, and harvesting turnips was one of my favorite things because it feels a little bit like an Easter egg hunt. You know, you go out in the field and you're sorting through the greens to find those little balls of turnips. Describe what it looks like on the farm.
Yeah, well, so kind of like what you said, it is very similar to an Easter egg hunt because you just kind of see maybe the top little dome starting to stick out and then these bright, just like verdant greens. So it's a little bit of a surprise every time you pull one out, depending on how closely they're seeded does affect the shape. You know, some of them end up with flat sides if they're really close to each other. So in addition to kind of not knowing what size you're going to pull up, it's also a little bit of a surprise what the shape will be. And depending on the shape and size, the flavor changes a little bit. So yeah, it really is just kind of a surprise every time you pull one out of the ground. Yeah.
So you also have another variety that are pretty stunning to look at. Tell us about those.
Yes, the Hinona Kabu turnips, another Japanese turnip variety. They are so gorgeous. So instead of being a round turnip, they're a long and slender, almost like a long carrot. And they have this little dip-dyed purple end, kind of like traditional turnips that we've seen. And then they have these amazing mustard greens attached to the top of them that I love to cook just as much as I love having the actual turnip. So those, compared to the Tokyo turnips, in my opinion, are a little more milder all around. They still have that really nice fresh turnip taste, only it's a little mellow throughout.
Okay, so are those more commonly cooked than eaten raw?
I think they are commonly cooked, but I think another popular use for them is actually pickling them. I've heard of this recipe that's on the Kitsoa Seed Company website called Sokorozuke, so named because when you pickle those turnips, they let off this amazing pink flavor, kind of like the cherry blossoms of Japan. So I think pickling is another really popular use for them.
Oh, how wonderful. I want to try that. Yeah. Remind us which markets we can find you at.
Yes, so County Line Harvest is at Wednesday downtown in Santa Monica. We are at Saturdays at Pico in Santa Monica and Sundays at Mar Vista Farmers Market.
And you have those great CSA boxes too.
Yes, we have our CSA boxes at a bunch of places, which you can find all of on our website, countylineharvest.com.
Wonderful. Thanks, Angela.
Thank you, Jillian.
That was Angela Britton from County Line Harvest. Check out their turnips next time you're at the farmers market. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
In a minute, dining as we know it has gone through radical changes this past year. But one professor argues that restaurants might actually benefit from these changes. We'll talk silver linings when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. As the brutal havoc the pandemic has waged on the restaurant industry continues, we look for a silver lining. It's the reckoning that happens when circumstances seem as if they can't get any worse, and the opportunity to change what wasn't working in the first place is finally embraced. To that, Alex Susskind answers, finally. He's a professor of food and beverage management at the Cornell School of Hotel Administration, and I first learned about his work in an article by Washington Post critic Tom Sietsema. Hello there.
Hi.
You know, it's so interesting to me because I, in the past times, I remember having conversations with people about how the restaurant business needed to be, quote, burned down to the ground for things to change. And yeah, pretty much that's what's happened.
Yeah, I would say that this is probably the most disruptive thing that I've ever seen happen to the restaurant industry, at least in my lifetime. I'm sure there were other periods like the Great Depression that were probably just about the same. But this has been devastating.
Before we talk about possible solutions, can you just run through some restaurant labor issues that have come into such sharp relief during the pandemic and sort of have been made more public than they were before?
Yeah, so the restaurant business involves pretty grueling work. It's a very demanding business. Anyone that's in a restaurant working is pretty much on their feet for the entire time that they're there. A busy restaurant means that you're moving nonstop. You know, wages in the restaurant industry, you know, have been historically low, and it's been hard for restaurants to keep up with the labor pool and the labor force when workers have other options. So when the economy is really good and there are lots of job opportunities, the restaurant industry always suffers, and so it's hard for restaurant operators to keep their staff, to find the qualified people that they need and to keep them coming into work every day.
And in terms of just the economic context in which most, let's talk about independent restaurants operate, how important is it to keep that labor cost really low?
Well, the restaurant business has pretty small margins. And, you know, the average restaurant spends probably about 30% of every dollar on food and beverage, I guess. And then they probably spend another 30 to 35% on labor. And you add that up, that doesn't leave a lot for other things like rent, for, you know, the other expenses that you have to keep your business up and running, licenses and electricity and utilities, repairs and maintenance. And so so that remaining piece of business after you cover your food, beverage and labor, which we call prime cost, there isn't a lot left. And so restaurant operators are always trying to find ways to, you know, to optimize their spending, you know, to make sure that they can keep both of those prime costs, you know, the cost of the product and the cost of the labor as low as possible.
So in this minute, when restaurants started to have to shut down last March and people were either let go or furloughed, it was the first time, I think, that a lot of restaurateurs looked at their business and had to think of a way of operating differently. How can restaurants tackle labor relations during this time? And how are they reconsidering their costs that are associated with labor and staffing?
Well, sure. So during this time, restaurants have more options, I think, than they did previously. I mean, obviously, they're suffering. They have to close. They're operating, if they're operating at all, at reduced capacities with lots of limits. But one of the things that they're able to do is they're able to actually start to pass some more costs off to their customers, that they're able to basically figure out ways to increase their prices when they have to. They're able to charge delivery fees. They're able to charge other types of things that other industries do without even thinking twice about it. And the restaurants have always had a hard time of doing that because of the way the transaction takes place in restaurants. Basically, the transaction takes place as you're receiving your food. In most sit-down restaurants, you don't pay until you're done consuming the meal. So that's a really complicated relationship that you have with your guest. In an airline or a hotel, you pay for that product before you consume it. And so they, just like use the airlines for an example. When fuel costs go up, airlines don't think twice about raising the price of the ticket or adding a surcharge onto the ticket to cover those costs. And they've been doing that for as long as I can remember. And hotels can do the same thing as well because of the way that the transaction takes place. And we do have some transient guests that just walk into a hotel for the for the evening without a reservation. But most of the time, you're planning your travel far in advance, and you're committing to a rate that you're going to pay for that room. And the majority of the money that you give them, you've agreed to in advance, and they know what that is. Restaurants are very, very different, with the exception of some catering and banquet business where you pay for the product ahead of time. So now restaurants have an opportunity to build in some additional support for their business that they oftentimes just have to eat. When the cost of business goes up, they're really reluctant to raise prices, but they're able to do that now if they're smart about it and if they're smart about how they do it.
You know, I was in the restaurant business for almost 30 years, and I don't think I ever thought about the fact that we're not paid in advance. And maybe that's the reason why you're so afraid to raise prices, because you have that moment of expectation and kind of solidifying the deal, as it were.
Right. And now we're seeing with takeout and delivery, you're paying for these products now ahead of time, where you wouldn't typically do that. There are plenty of restaurants that prior to the pandemic, they never considered delivery, or they did takeout reluctantly just because it wasn't part of their thing, that they wanted you to be in the restaurant and they wanted to serve you and they wanted to do all these things with you while you're there. And now, every time you order from Grubhub, and in fact, you're paying through this app. You're not even interacting with the restaurant anymore. And so, there are ways for restaurants to capitalize on that change in the dynamic.
What considerations regarding changing the menu did restaurants that formerly didn't deliver have to make? For example, high-end restaurants, what have you seen as kind of a constant theme through how they've managed to make changes?
Sure. So, high-end restaurants have the problem that their guests were not used to eating their food out of a cardboard or styrofoam box, right? That was not part of the process for them. And so they had to revisit how their food was being prepared, what they were putting alongside their main dishes, to make sure that the food would travel well, to make sure they could package it well, to make sure that it had all of the pizzazz that it would have had if you were consuming it off a plate at a table in the restaurant. And we all know particular things don't travel well. And so restaurant operators have to be really careful about what they're going to put in that box to make sure that at least the guests are going to enjoy it fully when they get it home.
Do you predict that restaurants that had to make this pivot will continue to offer these more affordable options once they reopen? Or do you think they're going to eliminate it altogether and reach for the tweezers, so to speak?
Well, I think there's going to be a mix. And I think also what's happening along the way, and this was happening before the pandemic, is that we were seeing a shift in consumer demographics and sociodemographics, where the baby boomers were the largest demographic group out there. That age group is slowly but surely disappearing. And we have the millennials now as the largest group, demographic group. And then Gen Z is up behind them. And they have different needs and wants. When they go to a restaurant, they want different things. The idea of a two-hour meal to a millennial is torture, where I don't have a problem sitting in a restaurant for 2 hours. In fact, I enjoy it. Well, maybe 90 minutes, but millennials have very little tolerance for that. And we saw a lot of problems in some of the larger chain restaurants, like Applebee's or Olive Garden, where the average duration of a meal was about an hour. And that's too long. That's too long for the younger demographic. They don't like to sit around. So I think these restaurants that have created a decent platform through takeout or through delivery will probably keep some of it in place, if not all of it in place, to service the market that doesn't want that two-hour meal. And again, I know plenty of operators who they wanted nothing to do with Grubhub or Uber Eats or DoorDash or any of these companies. So, like, yeah, I don't do that. That's not me. And they're all in now because they don't have a choice.
So interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Professor Alex Susskind of Cornell School of Hotel Administration. We've been discussing how restaurants are embracing new business operations to forge through the pandemic. We all know by now that some restaurant models are designed for doorstep delivery. So much so, they even have their own packaging. Think pizza, Chinese takeout cartons, even a bright pink donut box. But what if your signature dish is duck, pressed through a 19th century device, acquired on eBay and served tableside? Well, COVID doesn't make any accommodations for that. Dave Barron is the Michelin-starred chef behind the infamous duck at Pa Joli. He joins us for this week's edition of In the Weeds.
My name is Dave Barron. I'm the chef and owner of Pa Joli restaurant. It's an interesting little restaurant. It was originally kind of based off of French Bistro. We, you know, initially really started focusing on a lot of the classic French dishes, cooking a lot of dishes out of like the Escoffier cookbook. And as it's evolved, I think we're starting to build our identity more as kind of a French restaurant with a lot of, you know, inspiration from the produce in Southern California. So kind of lightening it up a little bit, moving less away from, I guess, the stereotypical bistro fare. When I first started cooking, the first restaurant, the first nice restaurant, I guess, I worked at, I worked, my first job from when I was like 14 to 18 was a summer job at this little diner behind my parents' house. But then after that, my first like real restaurant job was a restaurant in Chicago called MK. And then from there, you know, my goal was to just work at the best restaurants. And in Chicago, as I was leaving MK, True and Charlie Trotter were, you know, battling for who was best in the city. And I applied to both and I went to True, and True was just like tasting menu. It was absurd. It was kind of over the top. Like eight people sit down for dinner and all over to the chef's tasting, and each person gets an entirely different meal. So like the foie gras course comes out and there's eight different foie gras preparations, so no one sees the same thing. You know, most of my French style of cooking would come from that restaurant. And then after that, I was getting ready to leave, and I was going to leave Chicago, and I was going to try to work at French Laundry, but I ended up getting a job at Alinea, which was really where I wanted to be. And so then from there, it was 4 years at Alinea, going from line cook to chef de cuisine, and it was just like progressive, pushing forward, what can we do that no one else can do, you know, and how do we stay ahead of basically the culinary landscape. After that, we opened the sister restaurant Next, and so from that point I became the head chef of the executive chef of Next, and I was there for 5 years. And those 5 years, you know, Next is a unique restaurant in that every, you know, three times a year it would completely change cuisine. So it was tasting menu structure again. All these restaurants were tasting menu structure, but Next became less about the individual dishes and more about the experience within a single menu. So like every menu was wildly different, and that was the point. So that forced me to just learn everything. I don't know how I feel about fine dining anymore. I think when your priorities are forced to change, I think you start to re-examine what's truly important in food. And in restaurants, for that matter. Like, you know, right now, our biggest discussion internally is, you know, we're not allowed to pour water at the table. Like, it's a huge pet peeve of mine for my entire career. Like, you never let a guest sit at a table with an empty glass of water, nor would we ever, have I ever worked anywhere that's accepted this idea that we'll just set a bottle of water on the table for you and let you deal with it yourself as a guest. And now we're just not allowed to pour water. And you kind of look at it and you say, do the guests even care? Like, are the guests perfectly happy with their bottles of water on the table? And if that's the case, then the three people who've been wandering around the dining room just filling water to make sure the guests have it, you know, what kind of new value can those same three people add to a guest experience? And you know, I think with all the nuances that we've had with fine dining for so long, you're afraid to break those nuances, right? You're afraid to say, like a Dialogue when we opened it, it was a point of contention for me that we couldn't pull out chairs for guests. And it's not that we didn't have enough staff, it's the Dialogue was so small that if you stood behind a chair and pulled it out, you'd run into the person behind you. And so because of that, we had to look at it and accept the fact that we weren't going to pull out chairs. And after 2 weeks, I stopped noticing it, and no guest ever made a comment about the fact that we didn't do that. I think now with fine dining, you have to look at it and say, well, there's things that we can't do, but it doesn't mean the soul and the effort and the level of hospitality have to disappear. There's now an opportunity to kind of reapply a thought process and really look at the true meaning behind the actions that we take and the interactions that we have, and how much depth we can offer in those. Takeout and delivery was a big challenge for us because, you know, everything that we do was, you know, we fought for that classic French notion. And so the first thing that we discussed was the duck press tableside, and then it was tableside caviar and tableside desserts. At one point we had, I think, a caviar tray, a dessert cart, and two duck press carts roaming around the dining room. Which, you know, in hindsight, that was silly because we were just running into each other all the time. I don't know how we did it. But we did. And that was a huge point for me in this restaurant and something that we had to do. And then all of a sudden with to-go, you know, that impact of tableside's gone. We, you know, and for the first 2 months of to-go, we had no idea what to serve. The menu itself was not made at all to travel. And it was way too expensive. No one was interested in it. And for the first 2 months, it was like a free-for-all. We had, you know, one chef who likes baking bread who did pizza one day, and we were trying to sell pizza to go. We had like fried chicken sundaes. We had, I think we tried burgers one day. You know, we really had to rethink everything from the aesthetic of the food to the approachability of it. And ultimately, our goal just became make really delicious, simple food that has some connection to French cuisine. And, you know, the challenge to takeout and to go is you can't control it when it leaves your hands. You know, it's not like you have a server who sets down the table in front of you. So someone picks it up and throws it in the trunk of their car and runs three errands, then takes it out and tries to reheat it at home. You have to make something that essentially you could put into a deli cup and shake and then pour into a bowl and have it still be enjoyable. You know, moving into shutdown and even still sort of being in, I guess, like pseudo partial shutdown, the concern has always been the business and the staff. You know, when we shut down the first time, I think one of the hardest things we'd ever had to do was discuss with the staff that people were going to have to be laid off. That's a difficult thing to look at someone who, you know, moved here to work with you and helped you open this restaurant, and then you have to say to them, hey, I may not have a job for you. You know, we fight every day to figure out what the shifts are for the staff and if we can fit in, you know, a couple more guests by opening a little earlier or adding a lunch shift. You know, can we keep another employee or give another employee a shift? The first thing we did when we shut down the first time was we started doing our cheesecake fundraiser, where we sold our Basque cheesecakes to go to put all the money from the Basque cheesecakes towards paying for healthcare for everyone in the staff, whether they'd been laid off or not. A restaurant isn't one person. And I think sitting back and looking at that and saying, like, we are supporting people that have been here for us, we can't not continue to support them. That was the hardest thing about all of it. Like, how long can we last knowing that we need to be able to take care of and be responsible for the people who've been here for us?
That's Dave Barron. Find him and the Pajoli team on Main Street in Santa Monica. Visit their website, pasjoli.com. Coming up, boiling water is a cornerstone of cooking, and in the wake of the Texas water crisis, it's been in the news a lot lately. But how much do you know about what's happening in your pot? Find out after this short break. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. As I record this, some 8.5 million Texans are being asked to boil their drinking water. It's a horrific scenario that has me thinking about what a miraculous thing it is to put a pot of water on the stove and watch it transform from a placid surface to kinetic chaos. Boiling water can be a lifeline in a crisis, and it's a cornerstone of cooking. Yet for many, the act of doing it is still a mystery. So I want to share with you a decidedly nerdy conversation I had some years ago with Kenji Lopez-Alt on the science of boiling water.
Water's a bunch of molecules, like a bunch of chickens in a coop. And, you know, if you start feeding those chickens Red Bull, you know, give them a lot of energy, eventually one of them's going to jump over the fence, fly out of the coop. And that's sort of what happens with water at normal temperatures. You know, the hotter you get it, the more water molecules jump off the surface of the water and go into the air as water vapor. And boiling is the point at which, you know, the fence that's holding those chickens in, which in the case of water is the air pressure around us, you know, the pressure that the air is exerting on us right now and on the pot of boiling water. It's when the pressure of the water underneath it becomes greater than the pressure of the air pressing down on it. So suddenly that fence breaks and all of those water molecules rush out and quickly convert to steam and fly off into the atmosphere. So that's basically what boiling is. It's the point at which the vapor pressure of the water is equal to or greater than the air pressure around it.
I love that metaphor, the chicken in the coop metaphor. Okay, let's talk about the continuum between cold water and water at a full boil, because it goes through all of these stages. So sort of take us through the different stages, starting with a simmer all the way to a rolling boil.
Actually, even below a simmer, you have a sub simmer, and that's when little bubbles are starting to form on the bottom of the pot. Those bubbles form at, you know, really tiny microscopic scratches and abrasions on the surface of the pot called nucleation points, which you can't see with your eye, but basically every place that you see a bubble, that's a place where the pot has a microscopic ding or a nick in it. And so when you see those little bubbles forming and maybe a couple of lazy streams of them rising to the top, that's called a sub simmer. And that happens in the range between, you know, around 140 up to around 160 degrees or so. And a lot of dishes are actually best cooked in that kind of water. If you want to really gently poach a fish, say poaching salmon or poaching a halibut, you know, things that you don't want to overcook at all, they work really well at low temperatures like that. And then once you get above that, you're at an actual simmer, and that's when bubbles are rising in a really steady stream, and you see the top surface of the water quivering. And that's in the range from, you know, 160 to around 185 or so. And then once you're past the subsimmer, you're at a boil. You know, and water will actually start bubbling pretty rapidly, a little bit below the 212 degrees, which we know is the boiling point. But you know, once you've finally reached 212 degrees, then you're at a full rolling boil, and that's when you want to cook things like, you know, like pasta or green vegetables, things that you want to cook really rapidly with a lot of motion so that they cook evenly.
Wow, interesting. So let's go through some myths, some water boiling myths. Cold water heats faster than hot water.
Right. I mean, that one just sounds a little ridiculous, you know, right off the bat. A lot of people really do believe that. And I think the basis for that myth is that there is a good reason to use cold water instead of hot water when you're boiling or for things like tea, coffee. And that's that the hot water coming out of your pipes has a lot more dissolved minerals in it because hot water dissolves minerals better. So there's a lot of dissolved minerals from your piping, you know, iron, things like that, that can get into your water. And that can affect the flavor of coffee or tea or more delicate aromatic things like that. So it's always a good idea to start with cold water whenever you're going to brew a drink. But it's not going to boil any faster than the water out of the hot water tap would.
Okay, now salt. When you add salt, it raises the boiling point of water, right?
It does, but not to a very significant degree, not to a degree that it's going to actually affect your cooking or to a degree that you can probably even measure it. You know, for most cooking applications, you know, say you're cooking pasta or green vegetables, you're going to add probably about, you know, at most a tablespoon of salt per quart of water. And that amount of salt is really not going to affect the boiling temperature by more than a degree or so, probably even less than 1 degree. And that changes that small don't really affect the way things cook that much.
So then some people are listening and they're saying, but wait, how can that be if you have water and it's almost at the boil and then you take salt and you throw it in, it will immediately come to the boil?
Yeah, exactly. It does do that, and that goes back to the point about nucleation sites. What it does is it adds a lot of turbulence to the water. It adds a lot of little particles, and those little particles are the areas where steam can suddenly form.
So interesting. Now, alcohol. we're told that it completely boils off when we're cooking.
It will eventually completely boil off, but at the point that it boils off is basically when you've reduced the liquid down to nothing. So it's very, very difficult to remove all the alcohol from a stew or a sauce or something like that. Really, the most you can do is reduce it. You reduce it down to about probably 10% of its starting, depending on whether you're cooking with the lid on or lid off. You know, if you cook with the lid on, you might end up even with, you know, say 40% of what you started with after cooking for even an hour. Because, you know, the alcohol, when you're boiling, alcohol and water are both coming off in that steam, but they're both also staying. It's not like the alcohol is just evaporating on its own while the water is sitting in the pot. They're both coming out of there. And so you're reducing the alcohol, but you're also reducing the water. So the concentration of the alcohol doesn't change all that much. You know, so even after a few hours of boiling, you're going to be left with some amount of alcohol.
Okay, now covering pots. Do covered pots come to a higher temperature than uncovered pots?
They do, but you know, it's similar to the salt. They'll certainly come to a boil faster, just because you're retaining heat in the pot. You know, you're keeping the energy in the pot rather than allowing it to escape to the atmosphere. But it's not going to come to a significantly higher temperature than it would when it's uncovered. You know, a couple exceptions might be is if you have a particularly weak burner and a really large pot of water. That pot of water, when it's uncovered, might be losing energy so fast that it'll never come to a boil, given the small heat underneath. In which case, putting a lid on it will help. But you know, whether the lid is on or off, a boil is around 212 degrees, maybe slightly higher when the lid is on, but it's not enough to make a huge difference.
That was food writer Kenji Lopez Alt. You can find his bylines in the New York Times. And his latest book is actually for kids. It's called Every Night is Pizza Night. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. Take care of yourself this week and every week. Be kind, mask up, and tip well. I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.